Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast. The world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. Now, I've been wanting to do a mini-series on port towns for some time now, and the lovely Mark Vasey from the Scarborough Maritime Heritage Centre got in touch, simply bubbling with pride over his own town of Scarborough. And sure enough, it has a fascinating little history and one well worth sharing. Scarborough is famed for its medieval herring fair. Yes, that's the Scarborough Fair that was made famous in the song by Simon and Garfunkel. But it was also one of the largest shipbuilding ports in the country, with 12 yards on its seafront, rope and sailmaking in the town. Scarborough-built ships have travelled the world, encountering pirates, transporting convicts, and Scottish herring lasses travelled down from the north to work in the herring industry, while rich gentlemen travelled up from the south to catch enormous tuna in the North Sea. You simply will not believe the size of the fish that these men caught in the 19th century. To find out more, I gave Mark a call. As ever, I hope you enjoy listening to him as much as I enjoyed talking with him. Here is a man awash with local maritime history. He's caught on the tuna hook of Scarborough's past and is now committed to sharing it as widely as possible. Here is Mark. Mark, thank you very much indeed for joining me this morning.
Sam, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
So we're talking about Scarborough, but I should just say to our listeners that you are currently not in Scarborough, are you? Why don't you tell everyone where you are?
I'm just travelling around France at the moment, so I shall be back in Scarborough at the end of July.
Very nice indeed to have a bit of a break. We've been trying to catch up for a couple of weeks now. Are you born and bred in Scarborough?
I'm not. I'm a Londoner, and my maritime connections are purely through my sort of grandparents who worked in the East End in the docks. So coming to Scarborough has been a whole new chapter in my life, and becoming the chairman of the Scarborough Maritime Heritage Centre. Wasn't expected that one.
No, but well done you. I hugely admire your enthusiasm and energy to find out about it. I suppose it's all East Coast, though, isn't it? London's East Coast, Scarborough's East Coast, so you do share a bit of heritage.
That's right, and I was particularly enjoyed your last podcast about the Essex coastline and the boat building there. And Scarborough obviously had its own boat and shipbuilding, its own particular form of, well, they call it the Yorkshire cobble. And we built huge ships here that took convicts to Australia. You know, people think of it as a seaside resort, but it was an industrial town going back a few centuries.
Mm. What's a Yorkshire cobble? Tell us about that.
A Yorkshire cobble is a small sort of inshore rowing boat, and it's got a kind of slightly Viking shape to it. It's got a keel, a double keel, so you can land on the beach without it tipping over. And they're very robust in the North Sea. They make slightly larger, 3-man and 5-man. Cobbles. I believe they call them cobles in other places, but it's your typical sort of local long line fishing boat. And they were built with trees, you know, from probably from the Castle Howard estate and the forests of Pickering.
Oh, right. And were they, do they carry a sail or is it just oars?
Yeah, they had sails as well. And, I mean, the last boatyard in Scarborough closed in 2009, which was when we opened the Maritime Centre. And they actually donated us their steaming box and the moulds to make a Yorkshire cobble. So we could technically reproduce one if we had the skills to do it. But there's not many people left that can remember how to do it now.
No, that's a shame, but at least you've got somewhere to start. Yeah. Did they have a... I've just got a Viking ship in my mind with a big square sail. Did they have a fore and aft sail?
No, just a mainsail in the middle. And as I say, long lining was the kind of local fishing. They didn't really go out very far at that time. A very sustainable way of fishing, long line fishing, of course.
How do you do it?
The women and children used to go down to the rocks early in the morning and pick the flithers off, as they call them, which are what we'd call probably whelks, isn't it, from London end. The women baited the hooks. So you had a long line, about 500 yards of line, with about 500 hooks. They baited the hooks with the flithers and then wound that up on what they call a skep, which is like a wicker tray, carried it down, and then men would row out in the cobble, feed the line out behind, and you know, you caught enough fish for yourself and to sell and for your family. Very sustainable. And of course, all that changed with trawling and the invention of steam and diesel.
Did they took the line out and then just left it there for a certain amount of time and then brought it back in, hopefully with fish attached? Or are they kind of slowly pulling the line back in to kind of get the fish to go for the bait?
Yeah, I mean, we do have some glass floats, some quite old glass floats. So I'd imagine they may have tied the end of the line to a glass float and left it and come back to it. But they also might have rowed as well. Both techniques probably would have worked at different times of year, maybe.
Fascinating. And what are they catching?
Mostly herring. Scarborough was the fifth largest herring port in the country at one time. And we all know the song Scarborough Fair that was sung by Simon and Garfunkel. And that is based around this huge medieval herring fair. The herring swim past Scarborough in August in the summertime. So it was a place that a lot of fishermen came to. The Dutch came over. We had people up from the south coast and the Scots coming down from the north to all fish the herring off Scarborough in the summer. And if you read the very old sort of reports, you know, from the 1700s, you could literally scoop the herring out of the sea with a bucket. They were in their millions. Wow. The sea shimmered silver. You didn't even need a hook or a line.
No, I mean, and I always find it fascinating how localised a phenomenon like this was. So we think it was like that off Scarborough, but it wasn't, for example, off Berwick, which is a little bit further north, but not too far away.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the Scots, herring lasses, as we call them, travelled down from sort of Peterborough end. The herring, you know, started to migrate down the south coast in the summer, and the Scottish boats followed the herring down, and the Scottish lasses caught the train or walked. And so Scarborough would be mobbed in the summer with these Scottish herring lasses. And there's lots of lovely old photos of the whole of the harbour area covered in wooden barrels, and these women gutting the herring, 60 a minute, allegedly the fastest one. That's 1 a second.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
A whirlwind.
Yeah, incredible. And they would do that, you know, from dawn till dusk as the fish kept coming in. All their hands got very sore with the salt and sharp knives and the fish scales. But they made a lot of money and had a good time, did a lot of drinking, and even married a few Scarborough men. You know, there are connections with some Scottish families. Going back,
so they came down specifically just for as a working labouring job to gut the fish so the fish could then be taken off elsewhere. Was the fish put on ice? How did they get it somewhere else?
It was in salt in the early days in the barrels. It would have gone in with salt, and a lot of the salted herring was exported. Funnily enough, to sort of Spain and France, they preferred the salted herring. Later, of course, 1845, the railway arrived in Scarborough, and that took a lot of fish off. And of course, the British had a flavour for sort of cod, really, didn't they? Haddock. So that went into the big cities. So Scarborough's, as I say, it's been a, you know, if you're looking at the harbour these days, there's only a couple of trawlers, and mostly it's crab and lobster and, you know, that sort of fishing, shell fishing, really.
Yeah, it's all fundamentally changed. Just going back to these railways, I'm fascinated by this. I wonder if they had refrigerated cars.
I think in the early days, probably not. We've certainly read tales that the rail lines got so slippy from all the oil dripping from the herring that the trains
That's
couldn't
disgusting.
Move.
Oh, my God, imagine the smell. So the other thing that these herring attract, of course, is other types of fishermen, because the herring itself can be bait, can't it?
That's right, yeah, and certainly they did attract other species, and one of which, of course, was the tuna fish, bluefin tuna. And in the 1930s to the 1950s, Scarborough was the kind of UK centre for tuna fishing. We had very rich people coming up here, Lord Baron Rothschild, Hedley Lewis, Colonel Peel, and a chap called William Walter Dowding. All very rich men came up and fished for these tuna that weighed 821 pounds.
I was being completely blown away by this, and I've been looking into it a bit myself. I didn't believe it. I thought it was a kind of a photoshopped joke that people were catching fish. I mean, there was one with a guy standing next to a tuna that looks like the size of a cow.
Yes.
I mean, it's the biggest fish I've ever seen.
Yeah, well, that may be the 821-pound one. And there was an argument over that by one of the other members of the Tunny Club, that the wet rope that was holding the fish up weighed a pound. So he reckoned it was 820 pounds and not 821.
Yeah, oh, wow. There was some pride there, wasn't there?
Yeah.
That's a fascinating story. How were they catching them? What period is this? Is this
1930s to 50s, that's right. And they just, with a rod and line, I mean, local fishermen would use their cobbles to row out. The Tunny fishermen were harnessed into the boat on a special seat, and their rod
really?
Was harnessed to them. You know, this is like a scene from Jaws. You know, once they get hold of the bait, they would pull the boat along. So, they would fish, and it would take a couple of hours to land them till the tuna were worn out, and then they would use a huge gaff hook and then pull it onto a trawler, you know, or one of their yachts that was there. We've got one photo of a woman fishing. There was one woman that caught some fish, which is great. But it all died out in the 50s because we overfished the herring, really. The herring stopped coming, or the numbers were very severely reduced. So they've not reappeared. Occasionally there are sightings of very small bluefin tuna off the coast of Scarborough. We get porpoises as well. If they came back, they'd be worth an absolute fortune. That sort of size of fish, they say, would be worth about £10,000 in fresh tuna.
Wow! How amazing! More needs to be known about this. So I'm a fisherman myself. You see, I'm quite interested in this. What did they make their rods out of? Do you have any idea? What were they fishing with in the 1930s?
They're very strong. Have you ever heard of Zane Grey?
No.
He's an American fisherman. If you Google Zane Grey, he was actually a writer. He wrote scripts and books, non-fiction books. He made a thing called a Zane Grey rod and reel, freshwater, saltwater reel. And they're really strong, very short, stubby fishing rods. And the reels were made by Hardies of Annick. Very expensive. They have a royal seal on them. They were made by royal approval, stainless steel, and they're 8-inch reels. Absolutely, you can hardly lift the things with a very strong line. You can imagine 800-pound line.
Like a rope.
Yeah. So these things are around. We have got a rod and reel in the centre from the 1930s. We've got the whole history of what it caught and who fished with it. It was an amazing
time. Oh, that's wonderful.
Mm.
Yeah, I've just found one, actually. This was sold by Bonhams. It is an 82-inch Palacona fishing rod by the Hardy Brothers of Annick in six alternating hexagonal sections of bamboo and hickory. Mm. So, wow, with brass and steel fittings. So short, but incredibly strong.
Yeah.
I suppose bamboo gives you the bend and hickory gives you the strength.
Yes, yeah, yeah, absolutely amazing. And as I say, they set up the British Tunny Club in Scarborough. So it's now a fish and chip shop. And there's pictures of all these guys in their suits and ties with their pipes. And they used to, funnily enough, they didn't used to eat the tuna. They used to flog it to local farmers to plough into their fields, rather terribly. But they would stuff the tail. So there was lots of pictures of these stuffed tunny tails in the club.
Mm. Do any survive? We got any in the museum?
We haven't got a tail. There's a Scarborough Gallery might have one, I think. I think they had one stuffed tuna. Quite hard things to keep, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, fascinating stuff. Now, a bit later on in life, tell us about Scarborough becoming a seaside resort.
Well, of course, it's the first seaside resort in Britain. 1626, spa water was discovered, basically dribbling out the cliff. A local woman, Mrs. Farrer, discovered that if you drink a pint or two of it, it acts like a laxative and flushes you through.
So, what a fine discovery.
Apparently in those days, back in the 1600s, people suffered a lot from constipation. Their diets were very poor. So they could come to Scarborough and it was recommended they drink 7 or 8 pints of this a day.
It
would flush them through.
It would.
And then a bit later, I think 1670, a Dr. Whitty discovered that if you throw people into the freezing cold North Sea, they come out feeling amazingly good. So,
so do you have to have the 8 pints of
at the same time? Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So sea bathing was really kind of promoted and invented here with the first bathing machines for women to get changed in. Were about 1735. The men used to swim completely naked, apparently, but the women had to be covered, you know, from head to foot without showing an ankle.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Or an elbow.
So tell us about this water. Where does the water coming out of the cliff, does that bubble up from some kind of underground source?
It's just a spring, basically, from the bottom of the cliff. The Scarborough's sort
it's just normal water, so it's not like hot water. It's not like you have a bath or something.
No, it's not at all. No, it's just what we'd call mineral water, I suppose, these days. And they bottled it and sold it. I mean, sadly, today all we've got is a little rusty dribble coming out with a little plaque saying, "This is do not drink the water."
What I really like about that story is that someone had a couple of pints of it and gave them the trots. And then as they were sitting there in their gripey misery, they went, "Do you know what? I can make a fortune out of this."
Yeah, yeah. Entrepreneurship, yeah.
Very good. So the sea bathing thing is also quite interesting. So I tell you why it's interesting, because I live in a bit of regional competitiveness here. I live in Devon, right? And I would argue that some of the beaches in the southwest are a bit better than up in Scarborough for sea bathing. And I'm wondering why it happened up there and not down here, or Brighton, or somewhere like nearer London. You know, it seems strange to me.
Yeah, Brighton was about 50 years later than Scarborough. You know, if you speak to
it's
most
a seriously
people,
long time. Yeah, 50 years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that I mean, we're talking historically proven facts. I think there's a letter from some lady visiting Scarborough, you know, in 1730 or something, saying, "I've come here to take the waters and bathe in the sea." So that, you know, history is about facts, isn't it? So we don't know what happened before that. But certainly, historically, isn't it, people were afraid of the sea. There were monsters in the sea. It was dangerous. It drowned fishermen. It was a place that people kept away from. So the invention of the discovery of the spa water attracted people to Scarborough. It was a port where they smuggled brandy and tobacco and tea and everything. So there was already a beginnings of an interest in Scarborough as a place to go to drink water and gamble and drink. And then obviously this invention of freezing cold water, making you feel a lot better in yourself, added to that, really. So, yeah, you know, why specifically Scarborough, not Devon or Brighton? Only history can tell us, really.
Yeah, it's interesting also hearing about the herring being so thick you could scoop them out in a basket, and also the size of these tunas, these cow-sized tunas. The point is that there were monsters in the sea. And everyone, you know, it's quite easy to ridicule it, but actually, if you look at these old charts, they've got huge creatures. That even the normal fish were massive, like a cod.
Yes. Yeah, at least a yard long, weren't they? The old photos of Scarborough Fish Market, the cod are lying there, and they're over a yard long, metre long. And it's because we allowed fish to grow to their maximum capacity. And now if you see, you know, Sainsbury's has got tins of tuna and it says ethically caught by rod and line. But if you see the videos, they're pulling out little fish, you know, they might be 12 inches long. They're babies. They're not letting them live long enough to grow to the sizes they could. You'll know from all the old sea charts, all they had was pictures of monsters all over them, wasn't it, really?
Yeah. And you also have some fascinating military history up there, maritime military history. Tell us about John Paul Jones.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. I mean, it's a real saga with John Paul Jones. He was a Scottish captain. And during the American War of Independence, he was sailing a French ship called the Bonhomme Richard. And he sailed along the east coast of Britain, specifically off Flamborough Head, which is a few miles south of Scarborough, and decided to attack some English shipping. So this is in 1779. So this is, as far as I'm aware, this is the only ever recorded attack of the British ships by American ships in English waters.
Yeah, it certainly gave the English a hell of a fright. And also you have a famous admiral born in Scarborough. Tell us about John Lawson.
Yes, there's very little actually publicly known about him. Fortunately, a woman's written a new biography about him. So Sir John Lawson was born within a few yards of the Maritime Heritage Centre in Scarborough. I think the house, the original house, is probably gone now, but there's a blue plaque on the corner of the street there. Born in 1615. And so he was a son of a merchant, local merchant. And in 1642, he was a captain during the Civil War, and he helped Hull that was being besieged, and he helped blockade the Royalists in Scarborough. Scarborough changed hands a few times between the Royalists. He sort of went on to get quite heavily involved with civil wars, basically. So in 1659, he took the fleet, as they call it, to the mouth of the Thames to stop this sort of revolution going on against Parliament by the civil the army uprising. So he was he supported the Parliament and changed the course of history, really, although he was a royalist at the time. And he was sort of Cromwell didn't like him, locked him up for a little while. But then after that all sort of settled down, King Charles II knighted him, and then he went on to fight in Anglo-Dutch wars. He was in the Azores, and I think he was wounded in Lowestoft in the Second Dutch War, died in 1665. So amazing story of a little Scarborough lad that really did some very interesting things in history, and, you know, really not commemorated in any great shape or form locally in Scarborough. We're trying to change that.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating story, an amazing period as well. I'm very interested in that period. Well, let's just finish off. Tell us about your red phone box, which is the world's smallest maritime heritage centre. This sounds brilliant.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, just before lockdown, COVID lockdown, a local a woman approached us and said the red telephone, the last red telephone box on the seafront by the harbour, is going to be removed. BT are going to take it away. Everybody's got a mobile phone. Nobody's using it. You know, surely this is a historical thing. Can't we do something to save it? So we contacted them, and for the princely price of £1, we adopted it. as you'll probably know, some phone boxes have turned into a defibrillator sort of sites or libraries. So we decided to do a mini maritime museum. So we've got some lovely black and white pictures in there of the harbour in the early days. And we've got an audio recording when you go in, the light comes on, there's an audio recording. And I think the best thing for me about it is we found a photograph of a Victorian man standing on the exact spot this phone box is in about 1890 or something. Little did he know, you know, the phone was going to be invented and he would have been standing in our phone box.
That's wonderful. Mark, thank you for sharing these wonderful stories with us. And hopefully it will encourage lots of people to go and visit Scarborough and to investigate the wonderful maritime history of that area.
Great. Thank you very much.
Now, thank you all so much for listening to that episode. I hope to bring you more port town material soon in the coming months. Please remember that the podcast comes from both the Lloyd's Register Foundation and the Society for Nautical Research. You must do everything you can to find out what those two brilliant institutions are up to. In particular, please check out Maritime Innovation in Miniature. It's the Lloyd's Register Foundation's Heritage and Education Centre's latest project, filming the world's best ship models with the latest camera equipment. It's absolutely phenomenal. And you can join the Society for Nautical Research at snr.org.uk. It's a fantastic way not only of finding out about the maritime past from the very best in the business, but also it's a brilliant place to meet people and to have a nice time whilst you're learning. You can't fault it at all.